Hello, friends. Welcome to the Resonance Test. I'm your host, Allison Coden, Director of Innovation Consulting at EPAM Continuum. What does it mean to strive towards equity in a space as profoundly challenged, as fundamentally disempowering to its players as our American healthcare system? Generations of bias, if not overt racism, continue to inform how our providers are recruited and trained. This influences which patients are or are not heard and enabled to advocate for themselves. It determines the kinds of interventions and behaviors that are incentivized or withheld within our profit-oriented system. Dr. Gingy Lindsay and Ariane Graham explain the real human cost of unequal care to our Jonathan Swerzy, Senior Director of Innovation at EPAM. They also challenge us to look at the future. What kind of system should we build? How do we have to collectively change our perspective and our thinking to make it happen? What would it mean to address the systemic racism that underlies so much of our healthcare system with joy, optimism, and minds open to doing things in new ways? To make partners of patients and amplify the voices of people whose perspectives have long been overshadowed by the medical establishment's biases? The path to health equity is not through greater access to the same challenged and often failing healthcare interventions that vex patients today. Instead, it's to ideate, as Dr. Lindsay and Graham charge us, from a mindset of abundance and possibility, not deficit.
Dr. Lindsay and Ariane, I'm so glad to get a chance to talk with you today about health equity. It's a critical topic. It's something we've been thinking a lot about, and finally having a chance to sit down and talk with both of you is very meaningful to me. So I want to get us started by just talking about the U.S. healthcare system writ large. And as we all know, from an outcomes perspective, the U.S. healthcare system is among the worst in the world, especially among advanced nations. If you look at infant mortality, for example, a child here has a 70% chance greater chance of death than infants born in other wealthy nations, and that's on average. When you bring in BIPOC communities, the disparities become far, far worse. But I guess what I find myself wondering at the beginning is, you know, given the state of U.S. healthcare, is equity the right goal or articulation? Is, you know, targeting equity to something that's not very good a worthwhile pursuit?
I can start because I always, whenever I'm in a room with Dr. Lindsay, like to let her lead because she's much smarter than me. But in thinking about how can we fix health equity when we're having a hard time fixing the most basic stuff in healthcare, I always tell folks in these equity discussions that it's not a matter of how, it's a matter of how high are the stakes, right? I say that health equities are kind of a leading indicator, a canary in the coal mine. So if we think that these kinds of disparities and poor health outcomes can't spread to the rest of the population, I think we are looking at the wrong thing. And so if we don't fix the health disparities in our country, those will spread to the rest of our population. And it becomes not just a public health issue, but frankly, a national security issue. When we are sick and poor and tired, we are really not in a good competitive state when it comes to our comparative advantage to other nations. So I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, I would just add, I think what Ariane was also getting at is this, the concept of that rising tide lift all boats. If we're able to solve for those who are experiencing the highest barriers to good health, then we're going to improve the health of our entire nation. And I think even not just from a disparities perspective, I think from our looking at our health indicators and as a whole, not even segmenting down by race, we are doing way worse than most countries, right? So if we can really start to try to impact those who are most severely impacted or disadvantaged, then we can start to improve the health of all. I will also just say that it's I think the other interesting part of that question is that our system has not necessarily been designed to promote health. Our system has mostly been designed to offer acute care, and that was to garner more profits for hospitals, for drug and device manufacturers, and in many cases for actual physicians. And so some of this, what we're seeing, these kind of efforts to redesign incentives to drive more value, I think is going to be very central to kind of this concept of promoting equity. I think we might talk about this a little bit later, too, is just there has been a lot of verbal acknowledgement of the fact that structural racism is pervasive in all of our systems, including healthcare. but that verbal acknowledgement isn't necessarily been followed with action. And so if we have healthcare leaders who do not at their very core believe that racism exists and that they do have within their power some ability to address that, then we're going to keep seeing what, like, these kind of surface level solutions that band-aid, right, but don't actually fix the underlying drivers of health inequities.
Interesting. And I want to pick up on that theme, right, which is that health plans, you know, healthcare in this country wasn't really designed around promoting health. And I want to pivot to thinking about, you know, your roles as working for a health plan. Some folks would say, you know, argue that health plans have a social contract to improve the health of all of its members, its families, the communities they serve. And yet at the same time, we know that financial incentives are increasingly becoming part of the equation. And, you know, combined with those social contracts and moral imperatives, how is money going to come to play in addressing the moral imperatives?
I think continuing on that same theme, if you don't mind me serving, Arianne, I think if we're really honest with ourselves about who we are as a country, then we can acknowledge that at the center of, like, any sector or system is money. Like, that's what drives us. And even if you look at some of our history around successful social change movements, there have been few successful social change movements that haven't been aligned with some financial incentive for those who hold power. I think what we're seeing now, there are a lot of calls to action around equity from that moral imperative lens coming out of, you know, the quote unquote racial reckoning of 2020. I think those calls are quieting, particularly with the latest Supreme Court decision on affirmative action. And I think we're seeing, and, you know, you can read this on the Post, you can watch, you know, where investments are being made, that the private sector to an extent is absolving themselves of the need to address racism in their structures. And so by all means, yeah, I think the moral imperative is absolutely strong, but is that what's gonna drive change? No. If we're able to kind of realign where that money is, what does drive our systems, then we're gonna be able to get the attention of the leaders to actually make them action if it's tied to their financial success.
Yeah, Dr. Lindsay is absolutely right. The main thing I'd add to that for the naysayers and pushback who say, oh, we should treat every patient the same. They all have the same needs and therefore should receive the same care. I would respond to that even within our current construct of how we manage care within a health plan, we don't treat everybody the same. Mm-hmm. So consider a dual eligible population, folks that are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. These folks are very sick. They are often resource poor and they take up a lot of healthcare spend. And we spend a lot of time in terms of people, process, and technology in managing their cost of care. So when I try to get someone to move to a new way of thinking or a new way of acting, I point to something that they're familiar with. And I would do the same as we think about health equity. We absolutely don't treat everyone the same, nor should we, because different people have different needs.
You know, thinking about those incentives, one of CMS's initiatives is rolling out the new health equity index that's being introduced to Medicare Advantage. And I'm wondering, you know, what you think the influence would be from that HEI. Is that going to help move the needle in addressing health equities?
I think that's huge. I mean, I think if you're looking at the projections of where are all the healthcare dollars going, there are where is our population moving to? We're going to have a growing Medicare Advantage population. So you see a lot of health plans kind of trying to focus in on that MA business so they can garner more profits. And now if they're entering this MA business or this Medicare Advantage business, they are now going to be required to not only look at their data, not only stratify their data, but to action on closing disparity gaps. So closing differences in health outcomes for people based on their race. That being said, I think many of us, including myself, are fearful that if there's a change in politics of the White House, much of this work that CMS has been able to advance in the last few years is just going to be shoved under the carpet. And so I'm very hopeful that these are some of the key actions that really are going to drive change. It's because it's you're not going to get paid if you're not doing the work.
Interesting. Good. Thank you. So in prepping for this call, I spoke with some of my colleagues. Probably like many companies, we have, you know, employee affinity groups. Our, you know, one of ours is Lifting Employees of African Descent, called LEAD. I also spoke with another one of my Black colleagues, and in talking with her about health equity and the goals for our conversation, she said, please don't make yet another slave movie. She said, we really want to hear about or what are the solutions. And I thought that was a very powerful message to me. And so I want to pivot to talking about solutions. And I'm going to just ask really point blank, what are the specific actions that health plans need to take immediately to help promote health equity? What are those things that should be done, you know, yesterday?
I think even beginning from an asset as opposed to a deficit-based approach, kind of like what your colleague mentioned, yes, understanding the history and the pain and the ramifications of structural racism is important, but also there is space to celebrate what makes different cultures unique and use that as a leverage point to engage folks in conversation about health, to tap into the trusted messengers, trusted leaders, and representative figures within communities that are delivering messages of self-actualization and self-efficacy in managing our health and how important it is. Those are such low-hanging fruit strategies to even get people engaged in thinking about their health as we take more structural strides towards actually changing how we treat folks as they enter the healthcare system.
Completely agree. I think a couple of other just low-hanging opportunities. And moving beyond that lip service, what are you doing with your workforce? What are health plans doing with their workforce? Do you have diverse perspectives across your various career bands that are able to, that have some lived experience, that have some varying perspectives that can lend insight into how we plan and how we strategize? What kind of education are you providing for your employee base around these issues, around this concept, the concept of equity? I also think, I mean, you have to put your money where your mouth is. If we talk about health equity, I think it's very interesting because at the root of establishing equity is establishing a system that can distribute resources in alignment with need. What we've seen in a lot of organizations that have these stated commitments to equity, they may hire a role with equity in the title, maybe even have a couple of people, but then don't really add any additional financial or human resources to actually do that work. So then, you know, it gets back. So it's really like, you have to put in some resources into supporting equity to be able to actually advance that. I think other just very low hanging fruit that we talked about a little bit before is you need to look at your data. It's easy to ignore this issue if you don't, you know, if it's not staring you blank in your face. We just had the opportunity to look at some of our data around our maternal health indicators, and we cannot ignore that we see very large differences in health outcomes for Black moms versus health outcomes for white moms. And so, you know, the data doesn't lie. So I think that's another just very low hanging opportunity is just look at the data, look at the health indicators for your population, stratify that by race and examine if there are differences. If there are differences, then you know where you need to act.
That focus on data is interesting because as I listen to you, it sounds almost like you'd say it's good business.
Oh, absolutely. It's great business.
Interesting.
I mean, what we're seeing now, and I think across all sectors, but definitely in healthcare, is there's a lot of data available. There are few regional systems or healthcare organizations that have really cracked that nut on how do you comb through that and how do you harness that data and get really great insights that allow you to actually action. I had a colleague make a comment, something about data noise. There's a lot of data noise out there, a lot of distracting kind of points and figures, but how do we get really good data that is telling us This is where we're seeing issues with people's health outcomes. These are the factors that we know are driving these differences. And then with that, we know how we can impact.
Interesting. Good. And I'm curious, I just want to go back to Ariane's comment before too about this asset versus deficit approach. And you talked about reaching, you know, trusted messengers and trusted leaders. And I'm curious about, like, what are the ways in which a health plan can reach those communities or those leaders, those trusted messengers?
For sure. The way I phrased it might have sounded like a pretty heavy lift, but I'll just use a specific example from my day-to-day job. So my team is in charge of our multi-year strategic planning and annual operating plan. And I sat with one of the division heads for our company, and he has a number of associates that interface directly with our members. And he said, you know, Ariane, we have to drive some pretty key actions around raising up more Latino and Spanish-speaking people that are interacting with our members and making them feel comfortable in our care management programs, right? That is, again, very low-hanging fruit, but something very tactical that we can do that is, to your point, very good business. That will absolutely increase our members' engagement in our care management and utilization management programs to achieve the ends that we're going after in terms of cost of care.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think we also recognize the high level of distrust we have among many of our segments in our population, distrust with the healthcare system, and for very good reason. And so how can you start to reestablish that? I think a lot of that is not just saying the things, right, but showing up in those places and those spaces where those community members exist, and doing that not just for a picture, not just for a press release, but making that part of your business, part of your day-to-day job, right, that you're going to be there walking in step with that community to improve outcomes. And I think that is, you know, again, it's much easier to have that press conference and then fly back out, or to drop a check and fly back out, but to really roll up your sleeves and do that work in partnership, I think is going to be very key for healthcare organizations, Lilia, in the future.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lindsay, you know, a couple of times now you've talked about things that sound like maybe some sensitivity or criticism of I call it surface level issues, right? You give someone a title, but you don't give them a budget. You show up for the picture or the press release, or you mail the check. I'm just curious about that as a theme. Is that part of the obstacles to getting something real done here?
Even in the space of corporate social responsibility, right, it's very easy to market and to brand. It's much harder to actually do what we call, like, the quote unquote work. I think one of the frustrations in this space, I can say for myself, I was also just following social media and reading the blogs and the articles. It's a shared frustration for many people doing this work, is that it's hard and it's uncomfortable. It's a lot easier just to ignore it than it is to really think through, like, what can we truly do to be anti-racist? What can we truly do to make sure we are lowering barriers for those who have the highest barriers, and doing that in an authentic way. It's not easy. I can definitely recognize that it's not easy work, but it is necessary work.
Okay. And I love that thinking and that expression. I want to talk for a moment about someone who I have had a just tremendous amount of respect for in his life and in his passing, which was John Lewis, who is the late great U.S. representative. Among many things, he was known as a powerful voice for civil rights and equity. And, you know, back in 2018, he talked about the need to create good trouble and necessary trouble. And I reflect on that a lot when I'm thinking about means to create change, because that effort, that's a hard effort to undertake, right? The necessary trouble. Mm-hmm. I'd love to get your thoughts on the kinds of good trouble that you as employees of a large payer should be pursuing to advance health equity. What does good trouble look like in your context?
I can give an example of one that I actually did. And I think folks like Dr. Lindsay and I have the benefit of standing on the shoulders of like John Lewis and folks like him because of the places we've been able to ascend to and the platforms we've been given. Mm-hmm. So in my case, I engaged in some good trouble by convincing, and it wasn't a bait and switch because it was real, moving around resources to allow my team to think about, ideate, and design a different kind of healthcare experience centered on Black women who are not just facing health disparities themselves, but are often also decision makers around healthcare for their households. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I got to spend time and people and resources on diving into the problem state and potential solutions. And at the end of that project, it's not a business that our employer wants to launch, but we have validation from the marketplace that that is a viable business model that folks want. So we see sort of analogous solutions popping up in the marketplace that are thriving and scaling. And I think that was good and necessary trouble to get into, not just to devise and design solutions, but also to bring a great deal of awareness to my colleagues at the health plan where I work about the fact that these health disparities exist and that people experience the healthcare system very differently from other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think from a broader perspective, I see part of my role, I definitely see Ariane employing this, is to be a mirror for my organization. When I have a seat at the table, I'm the one asking those questions. Is that project or that program truly going to have an impact where we intended to? Is our resource allocation aligning with our stated commitments? Yes, it's important that we're addressing social determinants of health, but let's also recognize that racism stands independently. So how are we driving anti-racist practices? Not sure that wins any popularity contest for me, but that's not necessarily why I came into this work. I came into this work and into my role with a strong commitment to social justice. And so that's the voice that I'll continue to bring to any organization that I'm working within or with.
I'd like to take that question and ask for your advice. As we know, I'm a white man. I'm an empathetic white man, and I care a lot about this issue. But I would love to get your thoughts on how people who are not necessarily part of a BIPOC community can support that effort towards health equity because we believe in it. What does good trouble look like for us?
Yeah, I can take a stab at that. I do speak to colleagues and friends who are not part of a minority community or otherwise marginalized community and ask that question, what can I do? It feels so insurmountable. I said, a very easy thing that you can do is amplify the voice and lived experience of the people around you. Mm-hmm. So for example, if Dr. Lindsay and I are in a meeting, I've just said this to my boss, when you hear me say something and you recognize that it is coming from a place of knowing and experience, what you can do is say, did you hear what Ariane said? That was an important point and I want us to consider it. That is something anybody can do at any time when you see someone not being listened to or overshadowed or overspoken, and you know that they're speaking from a place of expertise and lived experience.
I don't know if I can answer that better. I think what Ariane is getting at is you know, allyship in action, not just in, you know, not just stated, right? So it's one thing to say, hey, I agree, but it's another to like to put your own neck out there, right? To elevate BIPOC voices or the voices of who are alarming for equity. I think it's also incumbent upon people to just recognize again that this is a problem. I think even in just you accepting that this is an issue in our country, in our system, goes such a long way. I have a colleague who does consulting work with health systems on equity, and a story he shared with me is that they were meeting with the senior team, and every time someone starts to talk about equity, the CEO shifts the conversation. And when they, and what was interesting is he said, you know, since we were consultants, we're not in that organizational structure. We had the ability and the kind of the purview or permission to actually call out the CEO on that. Like, what are you doing? Every time we talk about equity, you know, you change the conversation, which we're translating as you're not interested in this work. What the CEO ends up saying is that anytime someone says equity, he thought that means that he needs to build houses and he just doesn't have budget for that. So I think, recognizing that it is an issue and then being open to what are the ways in which you can address it that don't have to always be just let's try to address social needs in our community. Sometimes it's just like, again, back to very simple things like, have we looked at how our members are doing? Have we looked at how we're caring for our local community? I think it can be as simple as that.
Thank you. And that's really good sage advice. I've asked other people in the past, and one of them once told me, if not you, then who? Mm-hmm. Which I thought was a nice way of sort of saying you just need to do something. I want to ask, we have one last question. I know you've recently worked with some of my colleagues. I'm jealous that I wasn't part of that. But I believe you're familiar with our approach that balances, you know, desirability, i.e., you know, what do the members need from their vantage point, viability, feasibility, you know, in the eyes of the business. And I've worked a lot with clients before on health equity, and we come up with really sharp articulations of the problems and also solutions. But sometimes those solutions can be diluted too far in the face of those business constraints and business viability. And in some ways, I feel like it's an expression of the conflict, you know, that I see within the moral imperative. You know, it's almost to me like paradoxical. I'm wondering, what might be some solutions to this paradox, to finding that intersection between desirability and viability and feasibility?
I think for me, healthcare has always been a tension of two things. There's an actuarial decision around how much does this thing cost and is the juice worth the squeeze? And then there's a clinical decision to be made. Given this person's care and health status, what outcome can I hope to achieve for them and how do I get there regardless of how it costs? And those things are always in tension in healthcare, regardless of whether you're talking about health equity or not. And so, you know, prior to working at this health plan, I've worked in a lot of digital health startups, and that is always a tension we're coming up against. I think I appreciate the question, but I don't necessarily agree that there aren't viable. I'm not saying you are saying this, but sometimes I hear people say there are not viable business models that also help achieve equitable outcomes. And I think that is a failure of our imagination and not an actual truth that we are dealing with in terms of building new business models. So that's my take.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest levers or biggest solutions that you already spoke on was just realigning those financial incentives. I think that's obviously going to be huge. I think there are also a lot of issues with systemic incentives that promote kind of alignment and coordination amongst the various players in the healthcare system. I think that's in addition to those kind of fundamental tension points that Ariane mentioned, in practice and in operation, there are so many blockages to just having this like this kind of coordinated approach as a healthcare system. We are all watching our GDP percent spend on healthcare rise, right? We are all challenged with the workforce shortages that we're experiencing now. We are all challenged with the cost of these health disparities. And so in that, as a healthcare community, how can we create spaces or places or levers that promote alignment of all of our players? For example, as you're talking about financial incentives and we're talking about value-based payments that are intending to drive, you know, value and care, not volume of care. A healthcare system could have five different contracts with five different health plans that are all asking for 50 different measures. You know, that my plan wants you to work on blood pressure, and this plan wants you to work on maternal mortality or maternal morbidity, right? And that becomes then nearly impossible that you can't have 50 priorities. You know, how can we create some cooperation amongst even competitors to say, hey, well, we know in the DC region, one of our biggest issues is premature heart disease. So all the health plans will require providers or ask our providers to promote value in that space. And I think those are some other, and I think very low hanging to speak of. I think there are a lot of, you know, kind of cultural and cultural barriers, financial barriers, and others to kind of achieving that. But I don't think it's impossible.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you both very, very much. For me, this has been a really fantastic conversation, and I appreciate your candor and your willingness to get into some of the details and thinking through some solution spaces. I really am very grateful for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Yes, really appreciate it. It was a great conversation.
EPAM Continuum integrates business, experience, and technology consulting focused on accelerating breakthrough ideas into meaningful impact. At EPAM Continuum, we're very deliberate about the term innovation. For us, it means turning ideas into stuff that's real, because from our perspective, ideas aren't really innovative until they exist in the world. Dr. Gingy Lindsay and Ariane Graham, it was a pleasure to have you join us. Thank you. Jonathan Swerzy was our interviewer. Our producer, Ken Gordon, always has time for a phone call. Kip Palalis is our sound engineer, and I'm your host.